Session number 9862.
Brigadier Bagnold, Reel 2. So you were saying that Wavell wanted a threat on the Italians' right flank.
The idea was that any threat from the uninhabited, waterless interior would cause the Italians to think very seriously. Actually, it had a wonderful effect of making them... They'd just started the invasion of Egypt. They halted for 3 vital months, enabling Wavell to receive reinforcements round the Cape from England.
What was your next move in the formation of the long-range desert group?
Well, it was having doubled the size of it, we were able to go and raid various small outposts to increase the psychological effect. We would raid 2 outposts on the same day, several hundred miles apart. And eventually, having run out of small posts, Italian posts, I had the idea of raiding Murzuk Oasis in the extreme west of Libya, on the border of Tunis.
Which oasis?
It was Murzuk.
How do you spell it?
M-U-R-Z-U-K.
And on the borders of Tibesti?
On the borders, on the... Murzuk is not far from the Tunisian border, on the extreme west of Libya. It was so far away, it meant trying to get help from the French in Chad. The trouble was we didn't know whether they were on the Vichy side or all the Italian, all the French dependencies were loyalists in that they were loyal to the French government, whatever it was. So I took an aircraft, flew to Chad, where I found a situation in which the army commander was on one side and all the younger officers were on the other, on our side. I put my cards on the table and said, we're going to raid Murzuk. I'd like some help in rations and petrol in order to get home again. It's 1,500 miles. So the army commander spoke to the second in command, rather, spoke to the governor and said, this is our chance. Then he turned to me and said, I'll do everything you want on one condition. You take me with you. Take me and 2 other officers, and we fly the French flag alongside yours. The raid was very successful, but unfortunately the French commander was killed on the way.
How did that happen?
He was accidentally shot by an Italian machine gun. Well, not accidentally shot, but he was shot by an Italian machine gun. The result was that de Gaulle, who was then in West Africa, sent as a replacement a Colonel Leclerc, afterwards the famous General Leclerc, who re-entered Paris, the head of a French armored division. But Leclerc, I found a most outstanding personality, a great leader, who immediately started to improvise a desert column, having no experience of desert warfare at all. He started to improvise a desert column, determined to capture Kufra, which was too strong for our little forces to attempt. Such was his personality that the New Zealanders, who officially are not allowed to serve under a non-New Zealander, except with express permission of the New Zealand government. I'm quite happy to serve under him. What he was short of was navigation. He knew nothing about long-distance navigation. So I lent him a navigating truck, complete. And they were perfectly happy to serve under him. He captured Khufra, and that was more or less the end of the Italian campaign. About the same time, Wavell planned counterattack against the Italians, had cut them off, and captured nearly the whole Italian army. So that was the end of it, more or less the end of the Italian campaign in North Africa.
What did you do after that, after the end of that campaign?
I then left and got another job at GHQ in Cairo. I'd had enough of the heat, which was terrific.
Had your health suffered?
Yes, a little bit. It was beginning to suffer. So I thought it was time to quit.
How did the name Long Range Desert Group come about?
Well, when the group was doubled in strength, it had to have an official name for the official order of battle. So we thought about it for some time and decided that the most apt name was the Long Range Desert Group. There were other curious official titles. There was one little group had the official title of Popsky's Private Army.
Did you meet Popsky?
Yeah, oh yes, nice chap. Pinyakov, a half Russian, half Belgian.
Under what circumstances did you meet him?
Oh, I forget now. When I met people, you know. I suppose it was in the intelligence department of GHQ. He was on the same sort of thing, and there was a group in GHQ which was trying to organize a resistance amongst the Arab tribes. But of course, conditions are quite different. There was only a few coastal tribes along the coast who were not interested really in the war at all. They had to live as best they could. But that was the idea, and Popsky's Private Army was one of the groups who went out and tried to interest the Arab tribal, the coastal tribes, in doing something to help us. They did succeed. The tribes along the Cyrenaican coast in the east were very friendly, because I think they were more under the influence of the Senussi than the people in the west around Tripoli.
What was the nature of the work that you did at GHQ?
Oh, various things. One job was to try and go around to all the formations and all the units in GHQ, background formations, talk to them quietly, ask them if they really wanted all the men there on their establishment. In a lot of cases, they thought that their establishments could be cut down quite easily. One great helper in that way was the brigadier in charge of the anti-aircraft, of all the anti-aircraft in Cairo, who happened to be Mortimer Wheeler, the archaeologist, who was known to his troops as Flash Elf.
Why?
Well, because he looked like it.
How was he flashy?
With lots of moustache sticking out. Oh, a really bright, forceful person. And a great archaeologist.
Did you like your work in GHQ, or did you get restless?
which was all right. And then, after some time, I became deputy signal officer in chief, which was interesting.
Why was that so interesting?
Well, there were a lot of things to be done. The Cairo conference had to be prepared for, which meant a very large signal organization to be created with telephone exchanges, delegations from China, Russia, and England. It was quite a big thing. And then there was another interesting episode, which meant going to neutral Turkey and talking to them about the creation of a first-class telephone system between Turkey and Cairo. It was amusing because the Germans were doing the same thing, also wanted a first-class telephone communication between the Balkans and Ankara. And the Turks, having a great sense of humour in their own quiet way, allotted the same room for the terminal equipment of both sides.
How did you find the mood of the Turks as regarded the war?
Frightened. Helpful in a way which would help them after the war. If we wanted to install something for our purposes, the Turks saw it as an investment for after the war. But they were very amusing, really. There was only one restaurant in Ankara, one good restaurant in Ankara. We were all the Germans and ourselves were just in grey flannel trousers and a sports coat. Germans are the same. One met them at the bar. I noticed in the corner there were two people sitting at the table who were obviously Gestapo agents. But when one rubbed shoulders with them to get drinks at the bar, and if the Turks happened to be at temporary loggerheads with the German ambassador, Van Papen, they would quietly send a note to the British Embassy inviting them to a dinner. And the note at the bottom, please wear uniform. Just went up to the other side.
When was this that you visited Turkey? Can you recollect?
Oh, I was there at the beginning of the war. It was very soon after I'd gone to Egypt. The Turks were then frightened of being invaded. They thought we might get help from the British in Egypt. So I was part of a mission to the Turks to see what facilities there were. And we found them extremely helpful. One off day, they took me around the Dardanelles, showed me all the Turkish defences against our attack on the Dardanelles.
Were they impressive?
They were very.
But later, when you went with regard to the telephones to Turkey, that was, which year would that have been?
43.
How long was your work with GHQ? How long did that last?
Oh, towards the end of the war. Two years, I suppose. 2 years. Right.
What work did you take up after that?
Well, when the end of the Western War came, my father had just died, and the British in North Africa, from the Cairo end, the eastern side of North Africa, was just nothing to do with them. No, it's all over. So I asked if I could go home. So they said yes. So in 1944 I went home.
To do what?
I was released from Maui. To go back to my...
Of all the work that you did in the Second World War, which work pleased you most, do you think?
Oh, I think the creation, after all, is quite a feat to create a complete, a new and completely unorthodox military force in 6 weeks. And that was great fun. There's an awful lot to do. Everything was new. The clothing had to be redesigned. Footwear was different. Army boots were no good at all because they got filled with sand. Headgear was no good. They had to have Arab headgear. Rations had to be different. Navigation had to be taught to everybody. It meant teaching them how to take a position from the stars, as well as directing navigation with a sun compass I had invented some years before.
Can you tell me about how you invented the sun compass?
Well, it was obvious that something was wrong. The magnetic compass was unreliable because if you carried a lot of spare parts, like a spare back spring of a Ford car, the mere fact of the steel, a big steel lump being taken out of the car for use as a spare, the magnetic compass had to be reset. And you couldn't rely on in the car. You had to stop. If you wanted to take a bearing, you had to stop, get out of the car, walk away, which meant delay. It was quite hopeless for long distance travel. And as the sun shone all the time and every day, it was obvious that we could use the sun, which only meant a vertical style to cast a shadow on a horizontal graduated disc. The only requirement was that you had to turn the disc round to follow the sun as it went from east to west. You turned the whole graduated circle round. It had the advantage over a magnetic compass that it gave true bearings instead of magnetic bearings. We found that on a journey, a wiggly journey, avoiding obstacles, going around sand dunes and things, a journey of 100 miles, we were very cross if the dead reckoning was wrong by a mile. The distance being measured, of course, with the speedometer of the car.
Were there any other inventions that you made?
Oh, yes, there was conservation of water. I realized quite early on that one lost water in the car when it began to boil, not by boiling it off as steam, but by blowing actual water off through the overflow pipe. So the obvious thing was to, instead of having a free overflow pipe, to lead the water into a can on the side of the car, which was half full of water. So that if the radiator water boiled, it'd be condensed in the can. When that eventually began to boil too, it would spurt boiling water up onto the driver, who would have to stop.
Did that work all right?
Worked extremely well. All one had to do was to stop, turn into the wind, wait for perhaps a minute. There'd be a gurgling noise, and all the water would be sucked back into the radiator, which was full to the brim.
Any other inventions you can recollect?
Oh, the idea of getting, if one was bogged in soft sand, the nose of the car would tip right forward, axle deep in soft sand. And the trouble was to get it out. Going around the junk shops in the slums of Cairo, we found heavy steel channels, which were meant in the First War for roofing dugouts. They were about 5 feet long, what one could carry, one under each arm, just. You put them under the back wheels, scoop the sand away from the back wheels, push the channel under the back wheels, which would get directly gripped. The car would be shot forward and hopefully would get out of the soft patch onto hard ground. During the war, during the Second War, every vehicle in the army was equipped with the same channels which the army had made. But the first thing we discovered, we used them very successfully in 1927, quite early on.
Did you come across opposition from brother officers to the existence of the long-range desert group?
No, they just couldn't understand us. They didn't know. The army never understood quite how we operated or how we managed to keep ourselves supplied. But in the Cold War period, up to June 40, the idea of equipping a force of light cars which could travel into the interior was looked on as absolutely mad. The peacetime troops, peacetime staff in Cairo, whose duty was entirely internal security, had no interest in the desert or travelling outside the desert. I suppose it's because the Gezira Sporting Club was so attractive. But any idea of going on a holiday into the interior, even for a couple of hundred miles, was frowned on, mad, dangerous, might get lost. Always the idea you might get lost. Because, of course, the peacetime army, if a single soldier was lost, there'd be compensation and questions in the house, and a lot of trouble. So they're always on the safe side of trying to prevent people from taking any risk, whatever.
But you didn't come across people who obstructed the LRDG or opposed it?
Oh, no. Not after. After all, Wavell's talisman made everything. As far as they could, they cooperated. Not that they were allowed to know what was going on. Wavell's instructions were, there are 60,000 enemy subjects in this country. I can do nothing about it. So not a word of this idea must get out. Complete secrecy. And of course, to get a whole lot of things done, by all the ordnance workshops, all the supply people, ration people, all one had to go on was Wavell's talisman. And one's allowed to question what was for at all.
You must have been constantly getting this piece of paper out of your wallet to wave it about, were you?
Fairly often, yes. But they're all very cooperative. The chief medical general, director of medical services, was most cooperative. I said, I thought we ought to have a rum ration. It had been abolished in both the army and navy years beforehand. I said, I thought we ought to have a rum ration. He said, I certainly agree. Signed it straight away.
Did you ever find that people in the desert developed renal complaints with their urinary system because of the lack of water?
No, we were on a water ration, which quite enough. So 3 pints in winter and four pints in summer was rarely enough if one was careful. It lived at the bottom of one's own spare gallon of water instead of at the top, like most people.
How do you mean?
Well, everybody has a spare gallon of water in their bodies. Most people, in hot weather, they want to drink, and they overdrink. And they perspire freely, waste water. It does no good. It doesn't cool you at all. But if you keep on the lower, on the bottom of the spare gallon. You only perspire to moisten the skin and use the evaporation, which is 1400 times more efficient than water itself. You don't sweat so much, so you don't lose salt. And we had no trouble of salt lack. Whereas on the coast, and they didn't, it's very hot in a tank, of course, and they perspired very much, but they had enough water to drink. There was a lot of trouble with lack of salt. There was also a lot of trouble with dehydration. Both have the same, very difficult to distinguish the symptoms. They both result in complete apathy. In climbing in the Himalayas, they used to say that you suffered from what they called glacier lassitude, which was nothing but dehydration. It's too much trouble to melt the ice to drink water. So they didn't get enough water to drink. And they thought it was some mystery about glaciers. But you have to, just below the intake of water which is necessary, you get a state of apathy. Quite pleasant. You just don't care about anything.